Today's seminar, Leisure and Culture, we spent previous two lectures on people's working lives, people's home lives, and this is today's a bit more about what people did in their spare time, their free time, when they weren't either working or bringing up children or looking after their homes and their husbands and their children. The idea of leisure studies, the study of leisure as a proper historical concept, is relatively new. And although people worked long, long hours, far longer than you all, everybody has some time to themselves when it's perhaps too dark to work in the evenings, or on Sundays when, of course, religious observances meant that you weren't supposed to work on a Sunday. No doubt some people did, but you weren't supposed to. So there's always some free time, some leisure time where people can determine what they do with their time. And there's, of course, also public holidays. Christmas is a public holiday. Easter Monday is a widely observed public holiday. Patron saints days for those of a particular ethnic persuasion, St. Andrew's Day, for instance, for Scots, St. Patrick's Day for the Irish. And there's also that ever-popular saint, St. Monday, after a long weekend. Particularly popular among students, I think, St. Monday. So it's nice to see you all here, even if it's a Monday. There are class issues to do with leisure, because the more money you have, the more leisure time you usually have. Money enables you to pay other people to do work that you would do. For example, if you're a slave owner, you're a planter, then you pay for slaves who work your fields, for an overseer to manage your slaves, and you don't actually have to do any of the work yourself. So money can equal leisure. But that doesn't mean that ordinary folk, poor people, never have any leisure time. As I said, you know, evenings, Sundays, those are always times of, even for slaves, those are times when slaves aren't expected to work. I will talk a bit about the class basis of leisure later on, but perhaps you should think about almost there are different types of leisure for different sort of social groups. Often historians describe the activities that people undertake in their leisure time as sort of cultural. And by cultural, it's because they're sort of voluntary activities. They're a way for people to express themselves, which aren't orientated towards home and family and work. They can be not particularly productive activities. They don't have to be orientated around hunting or whatever that helps to supplement diets. But it just can be, frivolous activities. It can hopefully reflect what a community or a culture think is as important. But there is, of course, a distinct difference between two different types of culture. Popular culture, which is what ordinary folk do, and high culture, the sort of deliberate cultural act, and I'll make that distinction a bit more as I go on. You've also got a gender difference here, not only a class difference, but also a gender difference. Women's leisure activities are often about cementing social bonds. Remember in the seminars we talked to them about how women like to talk a lot. Well, they spend a lot of their leisure time doing that. So most of the time we're going to talk about male leisure time activities, because men actually spend a lot more time doing leisure time activities than women, it seems to me. And there are some aspects of cultural expression which women aren't able to partake of. First and most significantly, and again particularly appropriate for lectures to students, is drinking cultures, something that a lot of early Americans partake of. Taverns and coffee houses are the two main environments for drinking culture. Tavern culture is particularly lower class, not exclusively so, but popular amongst the lower classes, let's say. Coffee houses, a bit more popular amongst professionals, and they're all about male bonding. They're places where men can meet, neutral ground, I guess, where they can talk, share news, especially political news. Perhaps they can plot political moves. They can hear about the latest technologies, for example, about agricultural innovations, latest seeds, all that sort of stuff. And although taverns are very popular, they're not generally places where drunkenness is appropriate. Binge drinking, drinking so that a person loses control of himself and of his faculties and, dare say, his bodily functions, is not a good thing. It's seen to be a weakness. Losing self-control is a weakness. Because remember, control is all about masterliness, manliness, of being in control. But of course, temperance is also a weakness. People who can't hold their liquor is also a sign of weakness. So you get a lot of taverns in early America. They grew up partly to service the local population, but also to service the travelling population. They're often at crossroads, etc. And just like the network of inns and taverns that you get in England. And interestingly enough, there's quite a lot of women involved in taverns, but as managers and owners of taverns, because they have this sort of boarding house function, this sort of hotel hostel function, and that's where women come into their own. Taverns and coffee houses are often these secular communal spaces, and they're places which sometimes also have to serve as places where courts can meet, where grand juries can convene, and where you get sort of political campaigning going on, because they are sort of neutral territory. And this is an example here, this picture, Mr. Peter Manigo and his friends, a drawing from Charleston in 1760, and they're there in the sort of passing the port. We've got a little black servant who is helping them. And they're sitting around discussing weighty issues of the day. They're maybe talking about the latest news of the war. This is in the middle of the French and Indian War. Maybe the latest proclamation by the governor about Indian trade. There's lots of things which they would sit and discuss. And these sort of avenues become particularly important in the Revolution because they're places where they sit and talk about the Stamp Act and all the other acts that are coming from Britain and how they're going to coordinate resistance to these sorts of policies. How they're going to organise their resistance with resistance in other colonies, for example, in Massachusetts, in Virginia, in the Carolinas. How are they going to keep in contact? Well, coffee houses and taverns are the places where those meetings occur. And while we might think of sport as a key leisure activity in the 21st century, and something that was sort of invented in the Victorian era, I mean, that's exactly when football and rugby and cricket became properly institutionalised. Sports, of course, date back much, much further. Again, they are communal activities, and they are much more inclusive. They're cross-class and sometimes cross-gender. They sort of get people to come and partake, but also, principally, to partake to observe sporting activity. And you also can get some kind of social exclusion going on. Sometimes you can exclude certain people from participation in sport, perhaps make it too expensive. Hunting is the original sport. Very, very common in early America. It's sometimes not even seen as a sport, but just as a way of warding off starvation. And it's something that's partaken of by all classes of people, rich, poor, white, black. But gradually, over the course of the 17th and then the 18th century, hunting becomes a bit more of a class action. It becomes something that the elites do. And a bit like, again, you see in Britain, people hunting with hounds, with the dress, and the horses, and all those sorts of things. It becomes much more of a ritual than it ever did. And of course, that excludes certain people, because if you've got certain, racehorses or whatever that you're using to hunt, or a pack of hounds, those things are expensive. A lot of people can't afford those. And so you get people who ride with a certain hunt and have a certain status level to keep up. And then, of course, you get exclusive nature of these sorts of things happens with things like clubs. Here you've got a fishing club founded in Pennsylvania in 1732, but you also get, you know, these hunts, which are, have only a certain prescribed membership, and you can only join if you are, you know, part of a certain social group. And, you know, clubs have rules, and they exclude members or admit members based on a set of criteria which are drawn up by the members, so again, they're often self-reinforcing. And emerging out of sports, especially hunting, is horse racing. Horse racing becomes again popular in England in the 18th century, and that quickly crossed over to the Americas. So much so that people even have portraits done of their horses hanging in their living rooms, which is slightly sad, isn't it? But of course, if you've got time and money to breed horses, race horses, then you know you are wealthy and you have a lot of leisure time. But horse racing is also reaches out to the lower classes because the lower classes love to go and watch horse racing, and of course they like to bet on horse races. And that gambling culture is something that is very common in places like Virginia and the Carolinas, where it becomes very much part of masculine male honour culture. You gamble because it's sort of an act of bravado, and if you lose, it's again part of your honour that you pay your debts. People don't renege on their debts. And there's definitely a growth of people who bankrupt themselves through betting and gambling in the 18th century. Perhaps more surprisingly is the number of ball games that are played in early America. Often these come from England. There's a lot of ball games played in early modern England. But there are regulations in certain colonies prohibiting, banning these games because they distract people from their work, especially if these things are done on Sundays, of course, they distract them from going to church. But there's a wide number of these games that are played in a lot of different types of colonies, and especially associated with public holidays, a way to celebrate a public holiday, Saints Day, for instance, Christmas or Easter Monday. And here you've got examples of bowls being played in 1610 in Virginia. This is during the starving time, took by people playing bowls rather than growing crops. Stick ball being played in Plymouth, a sort of primitive type of rounders. And of course here you've got cricket, first described in the Secret Diary of William Byrd in 1709 in Virginia, and several games played in Georgia in the 1740s, and a couple of organised games played in New York in 1751, Connecticut in 1767. So people, English people, of course, have imported these sporting cultures into America in the 18th century, and it's completely unexpected, natural. But they will continue to play games they played in England in America. I mean, remember these people are generally English. Interestingly enough, the cricket was played in Georgia in the 1740s. It often involves the Scots, alone the Scots. These sorts of ball games can be interpreted as expressions of masculinity. It's a way to expose your manly prowess, your manly skill at a sporting activity to a spectator, a bunch of spectators that hopefully includes women who can showcase your talents to these women, and it's a way of masculine strutting, I guess, ball games. And perhaps not much has changed. Of course, not everything is done outside with a bat and a ball. You do get more discreet cultural activities, in particular the theatre, which you start getting the first purpose-built theatres in the early 18th century. Williamsburg, for instance, has its first theatre built in 1716. But they don't tend to have resident companies of actors. What they tend to have is touring players, touring a troupe, I guess, who put on plays, and they tour around various regions, perhaps a number of different colonies all at once, and usually they come from England. What do they like to perform? Well, Shakespeare is a perennial favourite. Never really goes out of fashion, Shakespeare, but Restoration comedies from the mid-17th century are also popular in America. You get the very first American plays written by American playwrights in the 18th century, examples of which are The Prince of Parthia, 1759, and Robert Rogers' Pontiche, or The Savages of America, in 1766. And a play about Native Americans is in itself quite an interesting development, culturally. Aside from the theatre, you also got touring circuses, which were very popular, which come to a town for 2 or 3 days, and they bring with them various freak shows, you know, the bearded lady, the three-armed man, exotic animals, the tigers, penguins, anything that was out of the ordinary. No good having a circus when you're just going to show a donkey. You know, you want to show something that people haven't seen before. That's what going to let people come and look at them, pay money to look at them. So circuses are increasingly common in the 18th century as a way of popular entertainment for the masses, I guess. But they concentrate in the big towns, Philadelphia, New York, Boston. Sometimes they make religious objections, people who don't like these kind of frivolities. But the fact that they occur and they keep on recurring suggests that there's enough people who aren't that bothered about the religious implications of them. And music, of course. Music isn't something that's invented in the 18th century or the 19th century. It's obviously going on for a long time. Different types of music. Vocal music, of course, is the most widespread type of music in America, just as it is in England. Vocal music, of course, doesn't require instruments, so it's cheap, and everybody, well, pretty much everybody can sing, even though some people might not think they can sing. And in the 17th century, you develop from this sort of madrigal style, which is sort of slightly complicated part singing, to much more sort of jaunty sort of pop songs, ballads, that sort of thing. So often they tell a story. Madrigals are often a bit, you know, religious, a bit sickly, a bit sort of hey nonny no, and you know, he loved his lass and his lass loved him and they went off and got married sort of thing. Whereas the sort of folk ballads are much more telling a story about, you know, pirates or a womanizer or something like that. They're a bit more bawdy, a bit more risque, let's say. But of course, each ethnic group comes with its own musical traditions, but particularly popular, or increasingly popular in the 18th century, is that sort of Scotch-Irish music, which eventually transmogrifies over the course of the next 100 years into sort of southern, bluesy, hillbilly type, you know, music. Other occasions why people have music includes dances. Dances are very common. Sometimes they are very informal sort of reels. They are a bit like popular Scottish ceilidh dancing. That sort of thing is very popular. But also you get much more formal dances as well. And that's a way of helping to ease the social transition from childhood to adulthood. Often these dances are about debutantes, are about balls, and those sorts of things. You get a lot of classical music played, Bach, and all those sorts of things. Popularity. These people are popular in Europe, so they're going to be popular in America as well. A lot of the music in colonial America is religious music. An example of which is this book here, William Billings' New England Psalmody, published in Boston in 1770, where you would get a lot of hymns set to music. But music does have a deeper purpose. People start to write songs about political issues, and you get revolutionary songs about British tyranny, about American freedom, being penned in the 1770s. And again, it's a way of spreading a popular message amongst a mass of people, some of whom perhaps aren't literate. So ballads and those sorts of things are always a good way of conveying information and political sentiment to ordinary people. And what I've done on the Early America page, where it lists all the seminars and lecture timetables and where all the links to the PowerPoints are and the podcasts, there's a link now to a music page where you can listen to examples of early American music as MP3 files. You download them on your iPod and listen to people singing 40 songs about somebody in a tea chest. So just for entertainment. So if those are sorts of popular aspects of culture, which a lot of different types of people partake in, drinking, sports activities, then there are other aspects of culture which are far more highbrow, far more exclusive, and they're all tied into this concept of gentility, of what a educated, refined gentleman would do. They are, in a way, living up to an ideal, an expectation, which is driven very much from what the European English ideal is. It's very derivative in that sense. It's not very innovative. A lot of the elites are closely linked to English culture. A lot of them are English, or they're second, third generation English. They often go to England for education, for their university education. They often have trading links with England. They often travel and visit England. So there's a lot of close ties with England. Of course, the people who've got wealth and money, they want to spend it on things which are appreciated culturally in England. The Americans have a problem, though, in that the elites in England always look down on Americans as being very provincial. So no matter how much money you've got as a South Carolina planter or as a New England merchant, in England you never quite cut it. You're always a bit of a provincial. And it's that sort of snobbery which they're always trying to combat. How do they combat it? Well, they try and create an American culture which is as splendid as an English culture. So it's sort of, I guess, a competition that drives this sort of gentility culture. You very much see this as an 18th century development. It's not really something that occurs in the 17th century, but it's linked to things like the growing wealth of the New England merchants, the growing power of the first families of Virginia. These are the people who've got money, who've got lands, they've got slaves. They are what you would consider the landowning elite in England. And so they can afford to be liberal with their money. They can afford to spend money on artistic, cultural items. Let's talk about houses, which is often the first thing that people spend their money on. A house. Houses in the early period, in the 17th century, are very practical, simple, one-story, wooden houses, easy to build, easy to knock down again. Remember back to our lecture on Virginia, we often talked about one of the signs of stability and permanence in Virginia was brick-built housing. Well, these things become much more common over time. And brick-built housing in the later 17th and into the 18th century, they're examples of the wealth of the people who lived there. And as houses get built in brick and stone, they become bigger, grander, more spectacular, a more public statement of somebody's wealth. If you want a very crude sign of understanding, you know, the wealth of a family, go and look at their house. Because any family that's got a little two-bedroom terrace, you know, clearly doesn't have the resources to fund a four-bedroom detached house. So that holds true today, just as it holds true in the 18th century. Here you have the Whipple House, which is a lovely name, Whipple House, in Ipswich, Massachusetts, and the Reeves House in Delaware. This, of course, is when Delaware was yet to come under English control. But both are simple sort of clapboard houses, very popular style. It's still a very popular style in American houses, sort of overlapping, you know, planks. Steeply pitched roofs, of course, in Massachusetts, to cope with the snow in the winter. And these are two very important examples of 17th century architecture which has survived to the present day. Pretty unusual. Williamsburg in Virginia, which becomes the colonial capital of Virginia in the late 17th century, has a lot of surviving 18th century houses. There's a good mixture here. You've got at the top there, a simple two-room, you know, ground floor, upper floor, external brick chimney, you know, detail here. This is a bit more important because it's built of brick, but it's not that much bigger than the house above it. But this, of course, is a much more substantial house, proper planter's house. It's built, I mean, I'm going to show you a picture of the Governor's Mansion in a minute. The Governor's Mansion is up there, basically just round the corner from this house. So this would be owned by a local planting family who also had a, you know, obviously a big plantation a few miles outside of Williamsburg, but this is their sort of townhouse. But it's pretty special as a townhouse, isn't it? Pretty impressive, pretty big. And again, it reflects the wealth, the power, the status of the person who built the house. And the fact that he built it within spitting distance of the Governor's Mansion reflects his own power and importance. Two more houses, again, showing merchants in the southern New England. In merchants growing in wealth. The Warner House in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and the Wells Thorne House in Deerfield, Massachusetts. Deerfield is, again, a very interesting colonial sort of town. You see the little turret on the top of the Portsmouth House. That, of course, would be the place where you could go and look at the shipping that's coming in. In harbour, you can see whether the ships were coming in or going out. And, a lot of port towns have houses with these sorts of turrets. And then you get some wonderful southern architecture. You get Drayton Hall here on the top right in South Carolina, a beautifully unmodernized house with its porticos. It's interesting, like nowadays it seems like these houses all face the wrong way because you approach them by road. And their grand entrance is always at the back because where in the 18th century the main entrance was actually on the river. And that's how you get to these plantations, on the river. And you come off the river and you come up, you know. And look how beautiful landscape ground here, butterfly-shaped lakes and all those sorts of things, beautiful. This is a rare example of plantation house after I survived the war, the Civil War, because the owners told Sherman's army that it was being used as a smallpox hospital, and therefore the soldiers wouldn't go in and burn it down because they were afraid of any smallpox. This here, of course, is Monticello, which is Jefferson's house, and again, it lacks these, you know, Doric columns. And that is Mount Vernon, Washington's family home in Virginia. And it's a pretty substantial structure. What these people here especially are recreating is a sort of idyllic English country house lifestyle. The sort of Jane Austen lifestyle where people have big landscapes, you know, to look out on. And they will change the landscape in order to fit what they want to look at. You remember in the 18th century, sometimes people built ruined castles, you know, on the hilltop opposite their house, so they had to look at them, they're called follies. Well, in a way, so something similar has been done here. They're not building ruined castles, but they will alter the landscape in order to make it look pretty. Even though the native landscape is pretty spectacular, but they like the big avenues of trees and parklands and everything like that cleared. And usually, even though all these plantations had slaves living there, the slave settlement is 2 or 3 miles away, hidden away, because nobody wants to open their window in the morning and look out at a whole bunch of slaves in your front yard. They can go and live down the road. So that's private architecture. Public architecture is again something that doesn't really emerge until the 18th century. And that's partly because when societies are small, and there aren't that many people, then public meetings, public spaces, can often just be somebody's house or somebody's tavern. You know, it doesn't require a big space for a public meeting. But as cities grow, as colonies grow, you need bigger spaces. But as colonies grow and people pay more taxes, you also have revenues to spend on public buildings. Often, and you'll see some examples in a second, these public buildings are very derivative of English styles, that copy English architectural styles, in effect reflecting this, you know, fascination with English culture, English styles, which you see in the Americas, and the sort of earnest need to be seen as part of a greater culture. So you've got the Massachusetts State House, built in Boston in 1713. You know, pretty tall, sort of three-story building with a turret on top. And here you get the governor's mansion in 1705 in Virginia. This again is in Williamsburg. But again, it's got a turret. I wonder why they have turrets all the time. This, I mean, Williamsburg's not near the seas, though. Not like the other Massachusetts. But you know the picture I showed you minutes ago, that part of the house. Well, I stood looking this way, so this picture, and I looked at that picture, that house is just here. So it's right, pretty much right next door to the governor's house. You know, building the governor a house like this, you know, says, look at us, we're a colony that can afford a nice stately home for our governor, and we'll pay for it. And that's again, his townhouse, we'd most likely have a plantation house as well, further outside of town. Oh, and there's a bigger picture of it. Here, it's a good example. I mean, this looks a bit like the British Museum, the National History Museum, which is actually a library built in Rhode Island in 1748. Look at all the classical architecture that's in there, and all that sort of stuff. And here you've got the Exchange Building in Charleston in 1771. Huge building, and this is its public front on the edge, but it looks equally impressive on the other side, which sits right on the waterfront, dominating the wharf, which looks out over the Cooper River. Some of the most important public buildings are churches. Often the first public building built in a place was the church, especially in New England. They built a church before they built people's houses. But early churches, they reflect the wealth or lack of it of the inhabitants. They are not. They might be the biggest building in the settlement, but they're still not that impressive. They're not that big. But in the 18th century, again, as money and resources grow, the congregation is usually able to afford to build a bigger and better church. They get more and more impressive structures. If you go to America today, churches are absolutely enormous. And there's some sort of growing together of style here. Again, I'll show you some examples. A very sort of typical American style of church, which you don't really get in England. There's a massive sort of growth of church building in the 18th century in America, which is not a time of great church building in England. There's a few built, but a lot of English churches, parish churches, are much, much older than that. They're sort of 13th, 14th century. In America, of the 18th century. So it has a sort of particularly American look. These are two very early churches. One in Massachusetts, and then this is the church Jamestown. All that's left of it is the sort of tower. And what's interesting about it is that it's very much like a defensive structure. It's even got arrow slits in it, just in case the Indians come, just in case the Spanish come. It has this sort of defensive role as well. The rest of the church, which is now built onto the side of it, is a later addition, but that bit, it dates to 1690. And I think it was the third church built in Jamestown. But again, you've got the sort of clapboard house in Massachusetts and a much more brick, solid structure in Virginia. I'm showing you that picture before, haven't I? The one of St. James's Goose Creek in South Carolina. But see here, two churches in early Virginia, just after the turn of the 18th century. And again, not particularly outstanding buildings. I mean, the one in Williamsburg is actually pretty similar, I would say, in shape. Perhaps a little turret, but doesn't look that much out of place for an English parish church. The little turret being on the top makes it look a bit weird. If it had a little battlement, that's much more like the English traditional style, isn't it? But here, you see, you've got two very, very different churches. One's a Baptist church, one's an Episcopal church. Built, one's in Charlestown, one's in Rhode Island, so they're 1,000 miles apart, and yet they look very, very similar. They like the old white marble, white stone. They both have a portico with columns in the front, and they both have a sort of wedding cake type tower. So you've got, you know, two very, very different cultures Rhode Island merchants, Charleston Plantation Society, and yet they're building a church on which religious objects should be very similar. And again, this is what I mean about 18th century American religious styles becoming more alike and quite different from English styles. There are some English churches which look a bit like this. There are some in London that are about this sort of period, but they're not very common in the rest of England. Reminds me a bit of St. Martin in the Fields. Doesn't St. Martin in the Fields look a bit like this? So there's a few in London. Again, London is a growing city in the 18th century. They're building new churches. Most villages and places in England, they aren't building new churches. So, that's architecture. Furniture. Everybody can make do with whether you can, everybody can make do with a chair. Everybody can make do with a table. That's not the point. Functionality is not the point when I'm talking about furniture here. Style is what's important. Finishing and copying the latest fashions, the most up-to-date styles, that's what shows you've got money, you've got wealth, you've got power, you've got position. So, ideally, you would import goods from England. If you want a Chippendale, I don't mean one of the dances, then you import a Chippendale. The problem is, the Chippendale itself is really expensive, and then you have to import it. So it's like doubly expensive. And only the richest possible people can do that. So a lot of people make a lot of money by basically making knockoffs. If you're a talented enough carpenter or cabinet maker, and you make something that's good enough, so it can pass as the sort of acceptable style, then you can make a lot of money. This guy, Thomas Elf, he was a cabinet maker in Charleston. And when he died in 1775, he left an estate worth £17,000, which in today's money is several hundred thousand pounds. And he did that by making, pieces of furniture that looked like the latest English fashions and selling them to planters who would pay him English prices for those fashions. Of course, in the revolutionary period, from 1765 onwards, it becomes an issue of policy, national pride, to patronise local artisans in place of English artisans. So a lot of these people, like Thomas Elf, would get special extra commissions rather than people buying money, buying their goods in England and shipping them over. Here's a couple of early examples. A very detailed decorated chest. Jacobean style chest, I guess. And then one of these date night tables. That's a fairly common style today. You don't still buy those, do you? We've got a table like that in our house. It's not strangely at all, but those sorts of simple date night tables. Very functional, but it's also, what you pay money for is only all these swivels. That's what costs money. The actual functionality of a table where, bits of it drop down, that doesn't cost much money, but it's all the fancy bits that cost money. Like here, it's not the chest of drawers that cost money, it's all the inlay that cost money. So it's the style that raises the price. And ditto, the mirror, it's not the glass that costs money, it's the all the little bit of carving at the top. And here, rice beds. Thomas Elf sort of designed these beds, basically his thing. And you can still buy rice beds in South Carolina. Four poster beds like this, because they have the design of the rice sheaves on the posters. And it was sort of like a local four poster bed that was, but he was such a famous man that he could, and buy these beds now, it's all worth the amount of money. And if you could ever buy an original Thomas Elf bed, you'd be paying millions for them. That's something really, really rare to buy one there. But so you could buy knockoffs, you could buy reproductions, which aren't cheap. And finally, let's talk about art. Art again transforms in the course of the colonial period. It starts out being mainly about portraiture. It's a type of very slow photography. You have portraits painted of your loved ones, to remember them, of yourself, if you're rubbing yourself. And people make money out of being portrait painters. Especially miniaturists. If they can make little miniatures which go in a locket. They're really, really popular, really common. I mean, you can make a living just doing little miniatures of, you know, the face and, you know, people make pay a lot of money for that. And so a lot of portraiture is all about commissions. You go in and you see an artist and you say, I want you to come paint my family and I'll pay you, you know, whatever for it. In the 18th century, though, you're going to move beyond just portraiture to landscapes, which is sort of like much more like art for art's sake. Portraiture is like functional art. It has a purpose. You paint somebody's likeness so that you can remember, help you remember them, or whatever. But when you start painting landscapes or historical pictures about events, then that's not the function of art. That's a much more public function, much more abstract function. And you start to get paintings of Native Americans, of Africans. And so you get the development of this colonial past, a mythology of a colonial past being created. The most famous of the American-born artists is a man called Benjamin West, who was appointed historical painter George III, who served as president of the Royal Academy, and he died in 1820 in London. And several of the really important American painters actually end up working and living in London for a lot of their lives. Here's a fairly early portrait, Thomas Smith's self-portrait, 1680. I guess he's holding a skull, it's sort of pending death, he's imminent death. He's got some kind of battle scene going on outside the window, not quite sure why. And you can read what he's written underneath. Again, it's a sort of a poem, presumably penned by himself. So it's full of symbolic meaning. It's looks like the Renaissance type painting, it's full of meaning. Yeah, Portrait of Ice Combs is a bit less ambiguous, isn't it? It's just a picture of a bloke with a wig. Could be anybody. But again, it's typical of the style of portrait painters in the mid-18th century. And here you've got another American artist, a man called John Smeebert, Dean Barclay Entertaining. And you've got this, basically a remembrance of a happy occasion. You've got pictures of family members, friends. You want to have, he's portraying, presumably this is Dean Barclay, he's portraying himself as an educated, urbane type guy. He's got friends, he's got family, we have soirees. It's a very sort of posed picture, isn't it? Picture their children. This one in with a little slave boy in attendance. Again, with a sort of fictional landscape, laid out lawns and stuff like that in the background, none of which really existed. It's quite an interesting picture, this of a Native American man, Tish Kohan. Quite interesting ethnographically, looking at how his hair and his dress was styled, things like he carried a pipe, all those sorts of things. Interesting snapshots, really, a bit like John White's portraits of Algonquins in the 1580s. Once you start getting portraits of Native Americans, you start to learn a lot more about them as historians. And two rather mundane, perhaps, say, landscapes. Here's the pastoral ideal, a little bit of people and sheep, actually, isn't it? And a sort of townscape with a river and a little bridge going across and a little church. Both completely mythological. They're not anywhere. They're not accurate. It's not like you sit there and say, oh, can you paint a picture of my front, garden? It's not that. Somebody has just painted a landscape. And it seems to be an appropriate thing for people to buy. And it's just adornment of their homes, isn't it? the way you adorn your house with posters or prints or whatever. I mean, we all probably have posters up in our houses or pictures.
So, it's just people doing it 200 years ago.
John Singleton Copley, probably my favourite early American artist, I have to say, because he's such a beautiful painter. Again, a little boy with a squirrel. Why do you have a squirrel on a lead? I don't know. But what I think is amazing about this picture is the reflections, when he's captured these reflections so accurately. Absolutely stunning. And this again, it's the reflections that really sort of strike me, the way he's got the reflections here on the table, the Max's table. And this, of course, is Paul Revere, famous Paul Revere's ride. But Paul Revere was an engraver and quite an important man in the American Revolution. Here's Benjamin West, the famous Benjamin West. This is The Death of General Wolfe, painted in 1770, commemorating a fairly recent event. General Wolfe died at the Battle of the Plains of Abraham in front of Quebec City in 1758. When both General Wolfe on the British side and the Marquis de Montcalm on the French side, both were killed, both generals were killed in the battle. But again, it's a picture that's full of dramatic urgency. You've got, you know, Wolfe in the middle, dying, somebody presumably trying to stop him bleeding. I quite like the flick figure of the Native American who's going like, ooh, he's being shot, I think, you know, sort of pondering it. But, you know, in the background, you've got the various battle scenes. So it's a very dynamic sort of historical picture. There's lots of information contained in there. Another one of West's, this one in particularly vibrant colour. I think this picture's been clean, or either that or it's been digitally altered. But it's very yellow. It always strikes me as very yellow. But again, you've got a sort of mythological picture, depiction of something that happened more than 100 years ago. This is Penn's Treaty with the Indians. And again, you could read a lot into how West is depicting Native American tribesmen. The sort of way they, you know, they've got the baby carried, the way they're dressed, etc. And the way that Penn himself is negotiating with them. Are all full of information about that sort of encounter. And again, it tells you a lot about people's understanding of the American past, West's understanding of it. And finally, here we get, again, John Singleton Copley, Watson and the Shark, based on a real event. Here's the poor bloke Watson, a young apprentice, fallen in the water in Havana Harbour in 1758, so 20 odd years before this was painted. Gets attacked by a shark. You know, quite why he's new, I don't really get. But anyway, here, although, you know, Copley deliberately left it a little bit, you know, vague, you know, it's not, this isn't Alien 3. But anyway, he's had his leg chopped off, bitten off below the knee. And his friends are trying to save him. He's got somebody again dramatically near trying to spear the shark. You've also got, you know, a black sailor, which in itself is quite interesting. A lot of black people did serve, you know, in merchant ships. But, you know, if you've got the shark and its teeth, it's not quite anatomically correct, but I guess Copley probably didn't see that many sharks. But anyway, the story is, of course, that Watson was saved. He went on to become quite an important figure in London, a merchant. Served in Parliament, I think. And, you know, it was quite a story, quite a famous story. And Copley drew this, you know, painted this picture several times. There's at least three or four copies of it. But it was like his calling card, after all, in fashion, because there's a copy in London, there's a copy in Boston, there's a copy in New York. And then he sort of arrived somewhere and then painted this picture, and it was like the story that people like to see. And so you can see you've moved from a, you know, art for, you know, very practical purposes, paint portrait painting, to art telling a story. And the picture of Watson and the Shark really does tell a story. And the fact that it was a real life story was even more interesting. And of course, Watson himself was probably involved in the commissioning of it. Certainly, he could describe things. And you can go into a huge amount of depth about positioning of all the figures and how they're interrelated. And somebody, if you Google it, you'll find this sort of an online exhibition about it. Tells you a lot about how each figure was taken from examples in classical antiquity, which Copley was familiar with, and this boy is meant to be some example of a Renaissance art thing that he'd been and seen in Italy, and Michelangelo this and Michelangelo that. So you can learn a bit more about it if you want to. So I hope you're feeling cultured, more cultured than you were when you came in.